Well, hello, Emerald Ash Borer. We've been expecting you. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh is here. We'll talk about the emerald ash borer and what that pest may do to the trees of Burlington now that it's been discovered there. We'll also talk about the community tree inventories the DNR has been conducting around the state and how those can help us plan for the emerald ash borer and other pests and diseases. Linda Knave, Extension Program Specialist in the Extension Value Added Egg Program, will also be here, and she and Mark will answer your questions. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and we're going to start the hour with an invasive species we've been watching for quite a while, the emerald ash borer, and DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
So we have been watching the emerald ash borer for a long time, and it was first spotted in Iowa, what, 3 years ago?
Something like that, a couple years ago in Almaquis County, very northeast
way
corner.
Up in the north. And now it's been spotted in Burlington, hundreds of miles from Almaquis County. What does this mean?
It's called firewood and other things that this pest can move. This insect does not fly. It did not fly from Almaquis County to Burlington in the last couple years. A lot of times near campgrounds, other areas where there's movement of firewood, along rivers, there's just a lot of movement of this pest. That's why there's quarantines all over different parts of the United States, but a lot of times that can still move. So even though we try to do everything right, this pest can still move.
All right. And now that it's been discovered in Burlington,
okay,
what does that mean for Burlington?
Well, just like it was in Almaquis County, I mean, the thing is, usually once a and we never really came up with an exact number in Almaquis County, but usually once the pest has been found, it's probably been there for a couple of years. Once you actually start seeing decline in a tree, it takes a while for the pest to get established. So most likely there's more there. They've just scratched the surface so far finding this first tree. We're going to do a lot more surveys in that area. They've actually put up some traps, doing a bunch of different things to really see what the population is. But just for example, Burlington alone, it's estimated to have about 700 public ash trees, and they have probably 2,000 residential trees.
Wow.
So things don't always happen overnight. It takes a while for the pest to get established, but once the pest does get established, and you get larger numbers, trees can start to die quite a bit quicker. Most likely within the next couple of days, the next couple of weeks, there'll be a state and federal quarantine in that county, Des Moines County, so folks won't be able to move hardwood firewood, and that's any hardwood firewood, ash, oak, whatever. It's hard to tell a difference for the average person, so it's any hardwood firewood cannot leave that county once that quarantine's set. That will include logs, that will include live ash, chips. All those, if a person is going to move those out of that county, they'll have to have a permit with the government. There's a process to go through. So if there's a firewood cutter in that county, they can actually sell outside of the county if they have the right permits and agreements with the federal government. It's called a compliance agreement. They actually have to process the material a certain way to reduce the threat of the pest. So it's not total doom and gloom. There's, you know, people can still go about their business and do things, but the average person needs to make sure that if they're having a picnic, this fall, Labor Day or something, it's probably not a good idea to, if you live in the Des Moines County area, to be the one in charge of firewood if you're going somewhere else. But this is a good thing for everybody from the sense that, again, do not move firewood. Do not move stuff like that. Even though you may cut your own and all that, and you want to save a little money, we may have things in Iowa that we could pass to other states too. We've talked about the disease bur oak blight on bur oaks. There's potential that disease could be transferred on the wood or in the material or on the leaves. And if a person had a load of firewood and they went to Indiana or someplace like that, we could bring something to a place that we don't want to. So the best way for everybody to help prevent these kind of things, and it's not just emerald ash borer, it's gypsy moth, it's the Asian longhorn beetle. This stuff, when it happens, it just keeps reminding us, buy firewood locally. Now, if you're in between those areas, Almaquis County, Des Moines County, at this point, things could change, but it looks like maybe just those counties may be quarantined. And if you live in other counties, you can still move firewood. Now, that doesn't mean we necessarily recommend that. But in Des Moines County, they'll be able to move firewood within the county. It's just they can't move it outside the county.
Now, we've talked about this before, and I lived through the emerald ash borer moving all the way across the state of Michigan.
Yeah.
Millions of trees died in Michigan because of the emerald ash borer. But that's a heavily forested state.
Right.
And Iowa is not a heavily forested state. So as this pest moves, and it will eventually move, right? I mean, as this pest moves in Iowa, it may not move as rapidly because we don't have as many trees, right?
Thank God for the corn and soybeans, actually. You know, I've sometimes we criticize agriculture for reducing forests and all kinds of, Iowa has gone under great land changes, and that has impacted the forest. It's not just agriculture, it's urban areas expanding and all that kind of stuff. But because of that space, this insect in general can maybe fly a couple miles. So that's, again, where the quarantines, it's if there's not an ash tree amongst that corn and soybeans, there's nothing for them to eat. And so far, they haven't converted the corn and soybeans. So in a way, that actually is going to help us. And for a lot of these other pests, for the gypsy moth and others, that will help a little bit. But again, it's usually, even with gypsy moth and some of these other pests, it's humans moving things that might have the insect or whatever on it or in it. That's where we run into trouble. So, yeah, that's going to help us a little bit. There's not the same link where it can just keep moving from forest to forest to forest. So that's going to help. But, human nature is to cut down trees, use it, do this, do that. There's always going to be potential for that human movement. But I think the way we're laid out, that is going to be somewhat beneficial. Now, Southeast Iowa, though, is a little more forested than some areas. There's probably about 50 million ash in our rural areas, based on our last estimate, and there's about 3.1 million in our urban areas. So there's definitely a lot of ash out there for them to find. But that natural spatial thing, it will be somewhat beneficial.
All right. And speaking of the number of ash trees, the DNR has been working pretty hard to catalog, to inventory trees around the state. You've been conducting community tree inventories. How long have you been doing that?
Well, for the last couple of years, thanks to the U.S. Forest Service, we've got some grants that have helped us. And this was all in preparation for what's happening right now. Is the thing that people don't realize is in Iowa, I actually did a master's on communities and forestry back in the late 90s. And one thing I found in that study was over 90% of our communities in Iowa have a population of 10,000 and less. Most of our population is in the big communities, but we have 950 incorporated communities, and most of them are very, very small. Well, a lot of those places don't have huge budgets, but they have trees. I mean, a lot of these small communities have streets, they have parks, they still have trees. So what the DNR wanted to do is help those communities basically inventory what trees they have between the street and sidewalk and the public right-of-way, and if there was enough time also in their parks, to give them an idea of how many ash trees do they actually have. And if it was going to cost $500 to $600 per tree to take it down when it came time, what was that going to do to their budget? But it wasn't just ash alone. It was to look at all species. We actually have a GPS unit. We walk up to the tree, we click on, and we actually get a sighting on that tree so we know what the coordinates are. We know the species, we know the size, we know the general condition of the wood, the trunk, and the health of the tree, the leaves. then we can also tell them if it needs a little pruning, a little lifting, raising, whatever it needs, and put all that in some information and give it to them to really help them think about the future and really think about their species. And one of the fascinating things is, you know, we looked at ash, but we've done 182 communities, most by district foresters and some of our staff in Des Moines. And we've used some volunteers, and then we've had 20 or so that have been done by contracts and stuff like that. But out of that 182 communities, looking mostly at street trees, but in some cases, if they had time, they did parks. On average, 16% of the street trees were ash. But 37% of the street trees were maple. So that means, on average, out of those 182 communities, 53% of the trees in the streets in the public areas were either ash or maple. Well, we have emerald ash borer, but then we have another pest called the Asian longhorn beetle that's in Ohio, Massachusetts, and New York that loves maple. So it started back in the 50s and 60s with elm. We lost a lot of trees to Dutch elm disease. So we really didn't learn our lesson. We planted ash and maple. And it just happened. I mean, it just happened. But it really brings to the point diversity. And even with maple, it's sugar maple, Norway maple, red maple, silver maple, hybrid maples, but they're all maples. So even we're learning that maybe we only plant 10% even of one genus or species. We really want to diversify. So just because we have five different trees, but if they're all the same genera, then we could really be in trouble. So we've kind of set ourselves up, but this really gives towns a good picture of this is what you have now. It also tells them a little bit about the age of their trees because we do a size classification. So they know if they have a lot of trees between 0 and 3 inches or 3 and 6 or 12 and 18 or 18 and above or 30 and above. You know, you might have some communities that have a lot of trees 24 inches and above. Well, that stands becoming mature. I just did one in Ely, Iowa, and most of those were between 1 and 6 inches, a very young forest. There's still a lot of ash in that community, but now it's still young. They can still maybe start to diversify and do things. So it really helps communities take a really good picture and start planning for, because a lot of these communities don't have equipment. They need to decide, well, if we have even 25 ash trees, how are we going to handle these when we lose them? Some communities might have 90 or 100 or a couple hundred. Some of the big communities have 10 to 15,000. So
and taking down a big tree costs a lot of money.
Right. So we're trying to help them plan ahead.
All right. Well, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment with DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh. Horticulturist Linda Nave will be joining us in just a moment as well, and she and Mark will answer your questions about the plants and trees in your life. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100, Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Horticulture Day today, and we've been talking about trees and invasive species with DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh. Joining the conversation now is Linda Nave, Extension Program Specialist, Iowa State University in the Extension Value Added Agriculture Program. Good morning, Linda.
Good morning, Charity, and good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here today, and let's get to some calls. You can join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can post on our Facebook page. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And let's go to Michael, who's on the phone from Harper. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
Hi.
Mark and Linda and you. I was trying so hard to remember all the names. Several years ago, we were fortunate to have in our community a botany naturalist, and he had a acreage, and he took us around to different plants, and he had planted this new plant, and it had a insect on it that he had never seen before, and he wondered aloud what good that insect might do. I wonder if the people who are studying the ash borer and these other insects are studying the insects that might devour them or control them. I think that would be an interesting study.
Well, actually, that's a great question, Michael, and that this always comes up when new pests come. That the thing to remember that this pest is from Asia, so it came across, and usually when a pest like that comes, it doesn't have natural predators. So the first thing they often do is they go back to the location where that insect was to see if there was anything that controlled it. And that's always a scary thing because if you find something over there, you bring it over here, you're always concerned, what is that insect going to do once it gets over here? It may attack that insect, but then it may attack other insects that you don't want it to. So there's a big process they go through to monitor to see how those insects will react and stuff. And they've actually introduced some parasitic wasps and a few other things into the United States. But at the same time, people are watching what some of our native critters are doing to this pest. And they have found a few that may have an impact. There's a couple different predator insects that seem to like emerald ash borer, but they don't know to what degree. But there are some folks doing some studies to see what's going to happen. And that's the other thing is time is a big thing for us, too, because, when this pest was first found in about 2002, they think it might have been there since 1990. And when they started doing research on it, there was about 2 pages of research from Asia on this pest. So we basically in the United States started from scratch. But we've gone leaps and bounds. Michigan State and some of the other universities up in Northeast where this pest was introduced have done great jobs in looking at even the preferences of different species. At first, we said all ash, are probably going to be impacted, but that's probably going to happen, but there may be some differences in how different species are preferenced. So that's a great question, Michael.
Well, and with biological controls, you have to be extremely careful that you're not introducing a new pest,
that's
right?
What I'm saying is there's a huge regimen, and we've learned that about the Asian lady beetle and other things that have been introduced for different reasons that we have to be very careful. But in that same process, the researchers have looked at some other pests, and they are starting to find a few things that I wish I could think of it, but there's actually it's a wasp or something that actually will carry these things back to their nest. And one researcher was actually looking at it as a way to find emerald ash borer in areas. So they were actually watching the nest of these critters, and they were actually bringing emerald ash borer in areas that they hadn't found it yet. So they were using it maybe as a way to actually monitor.
Wow.
But it might be actually having some impact on the populations. The other thing that happens, too, when they introduce these things, there's often a big lag effect. It takes time for the populations of these predators to build up enough to really impact the population. So there's a lot to learn out there. But great question.
All right, Michael, thank you so much for your call. And here's a question from Joel for you, Linda. And it's a botanical question, but it sounds a little philosophical to me. If raspberries and strawberries propagate by sending out runners, then what is the purpose of making seeds in the berries?
Well, the seeds in the berries are the natural response of a plant to propagate itself and perpetuate itself. So the seed is very important. Seed is also very important when it comes to breeding programs. The seed is the genetic material within the plant. When a raspberry or a strawberry sends out runners or suckers, to speak of with the raspberries, that is a vegetative propagation method in which the offspring, in this case the runner plant, is exactly the same as its parent plant. Through genetics, we need seed propagation, through sexual propagation, to get new varieties, new improved varieties, and changes in the whole genotypes.
All right. And also, I suppose it helps the plant travel, too.
Yes, it does. It helps perpetuate the species.
It helps my stomach be happy, too.
Yes, it does.
That's very important. Sorry.
Unless you have diverticulitis.
All right. Well, that's for another show. Let's get back to the phones. Dave is on the line in Norwalk. Hi, Dave.
Hi, you guys. Thanks for taking my call. I live near Lake Colchester in Lakewood in Norwalk. And about 2 years ago, I moved into a house that had a beautiful conifer in the backyard. And when during that drought, it just kind of got brown a little bit. And I'm not sure what kind it is. Some of the branches and the needles got, it was a long needle pine, and it got, just got brown. They started dying, and then the whole tree just died, like bang, it happened. And I thought, well, it's in a bad spot. There were some other trees trimmed down. I didn't think much of it. But then there's a couple more that are just really nice, picturesque trees down by the beach, by the lake. And they're doing the exact same thing. The limbs are getting kind of brown, and as the summer progresses, and we had all that rain, so I don't know, but I also heard that we're still under some kind of drought conditions. They seem to be going the same way, and I've seen that around, and I'm wondering if this is just stress on these trees, or maybe there's some kind of insect or something going on with those guys. And I'll just take my answer off the air. Thanks very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Dave. Mark?
That's a good question, Dave. And actually, the best answer is it depends. And it depends on the species. We are still seeing response from the drought, and I think we'll continue. The thing we have to remember about drought is it's an extreme condition. And when you cause root stress to a plant, especially a tree, even a shrub, you may see response 3 to 5 years after that stress period. If that tree doesn't recover, and then you have, I mean, this year we had really wet conditions, but I walked to work this morning and I noticed some kind of leaf stress on some different trees, actually internal yellowing, which often is a dryness impact because we haven't had a lot of water here lately, depending on where you're at and stuff like that. So that drought is a possibility. But the thing too, Dave, there's a number of species, species out there that conifer species that have some disease problems too. One I think of is Scotch pine. Gets a disease called pine wilt. Kind of fits the symptoms you're talking about a little bit. We also, with the wet conditions this year and a couple years ago, we have some decline on the blue spruce where they die from the bottom up. So what I would recommend to you, Dave, is to take some samples into the extension office and get the species identified first. See if it's a Scotch pine, an Austrian pine, a white pine, what it might be. If it's a white pine, they don't have a lot of disease and insect problems. And if it's really dry, it could be dry related. But if it's something like an Austrian pine or a Scotch pine, there could be some disease issues there too. So I would take some digital pictures with you, take some samples in, and maybe take some samples that basically show the browning that you're seeing, but also some green ones so they can identify that species, because it could be either or. I get the call all the time is, Mark, why are all the evergreens dying? Well, my answer is they're not all dying. It's certain species. Another species that really browned up was Arborvitae. We think there's some drought related, but some of the research actually shows some of these trees have some root rot problems. Some have had some beetle problems. There isn't one thing that's hitting it every time, but on some of the species there are specific disease and insect problems. So that species, especially on the evergreens, is really critical in the diagnosis.
All right. Dave, thanks a lot for your call. And you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh is here today. Linda Nave from Iowa State University Extension is here as well. They're here to answer your questions. 866-780-9100. Andres is next from near Iowa City. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a question regarding the Japanese beetles. I've been noticing that the, especially in the linden trees, that the Japanese beetles seem to be focusing or targeting one tree at a time, generally. And I was just wondering why.
Well, that happens to be one of their favorite foods, along with roses, crab apples, birch, a number of species. But they really seem to like linden. But they're also getting on our crop species, too. I was actually looking at a tree planting the other day and walked into a soybean field that was completely infested with
really
with Japanese beetle. So They have many different species they like, and some better than the others. I don't see them as much on some of the oaks, some of the maples, but they really seem to like the linden. And then just the way they eat, they seem to come together and just go in groves.
Finish a tree off and then move on.
I actually had my first call 2 weeks ago where one of my a colleague of mine called me in the middle of the day and said, "You aren't going to believe this. We had a swarm of Japanese beetles go through our work area today." He said there was thousands of them. And I'm seeing real spotty populations in the Iowa City, Cedar Rapids. They're out there, but some places you see them, some places you don't. But to answer your question, really, linden is one of their favorite foods, and they're just going to come to those trees and just eat, eat, eat. And they're not going to stop eating until the green is gone. And that's usually how they end up. They'll end up brown. The thing to remember is usually these trees can take some of that defoliation from year to year for a couple years. At some point, I know in Cedar Rapids we've had some trees that maybe – have been eaten 5 or 6 years in a row. I've seen a few of those trees succumb to some other stresses, maybe borers or some other diseases. But the drought, too, is going to add to that stress. So usually they can recover, but it's just going to depend. But they really like linden.
All right. Next up, Tom is on the line from Des Moines. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
This is a houseplant question. I have an orchid cactus that appears to have some kind of fungus on it that I can't get rid of. I've tried poison on it some time ago, and I didn't want to use a lot of that, so I talked to the person at the greenhouse, and they said try and soap and water, and it just keeps coming back, and it's having a really rough time.
Okay.
It's not going to make it.
Let's go back, and what kind of plant, an orchid cactus?
Orchid cactus, it's kind of in a similar family to Christmas cactus,
okay.
Except it's bigger.
And what kind of fungus symptoms do you have on that?
Kind of a whitish-brownish spot that kind of starts out small and kind of just develops all over the plant.
Okay, yeah, it sounds like a leaf spot. Now, is it on the new growth or the old growth?
It's the new growth is fine for a little bit, but soon it starts showing up on the new growth, too.
Mm.
And it's just making it very difficult for the plant to make any headway. It's kind of stayed in the same condition as it was when I bought it. So,
what kind of environment do you keep that in?
I try to get it outside the house during the morning hours when there's not a lot of bright, hot sunlight on it, but otherwise it's inside the house during the day.
Hmm.
With a little bit of air conditioning, unfortunately. You know, I'd rather have it outside, but I don't have a good spot for it out of the sun.
Okay. You said you've sprayed for it?
I sprayed some kind of a poison. I would have to look. Mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure what it is. Originally, and I didn't want to use a lot of that, and she said try soap and water and just wash it off.
No.
But it keeps coming back.
That won't do it, to be honest with you. I'm wondering whether it isn't an environmental factor at play as well. There's a situation in plants called edema, and it's caused by especially fleshy leaf plants. It's caused by inconsistent water, too much, too little, and the plant sort of reacts, the cells burst, and if you see, and it's sort of an irregular pattern on the plant. So if you see that going on, it may be due to something in the root system and the water uptake and the quantity of water you're giving your plant. And it's not just going to show up on new foliage, it'll be on the older foliage as well.
Okay.
But as far as what you spray on it, if you really do think and diagnose it as a fungal organism, I would definitely use a fungicide labeled for houseplant use.
Okay. Because it's not a scale. I've had scale on plants before.
You'd definitely be able to tell if it's a scale because they
I hate to lose it because they're expensive plants. And
yes, they are.
It could be a nice plant if I could get it to live.
Right. And if you really are concerned about finding out what it is, you can go to the Iowa State University Insect and Plant Diagnostic Lab website and send in a sample. They have forms there. And that way they'll be able to diagnose specifically if it is a fungal organism or it is a physiological disorder.
And what was that website again?
It's at the Iowa State. It's www.iastate.edu.
Okay.
And then if you go into the directory, look for insect and Plant Disease Diagnostic Lab.
Okay. All right. Okay, thank you very much.
All right, good
You're
luck
welcome.
With that.
Yep.
Okay. Thanks a lot for your call, Tom. And you are welcome to join our conversation as well at 866-780-9100. We have room for your call right now. Here's a question from Janet. My hosta flowers look wilted or dead. Others in the neighborhood look much better. Why are mine looking droopy, and can I cut the flowers off?
Why yours are looking droopy? Could be a water stress problem. It could be you have something affecting its root system. It could be it's just too much sun and too hot right now. And that's very likely if it's exposed in an area where it's not entirely shady. Hostas are really pretty hardy and pretty tolerant of most things. If you find it is wilting, it's obviously a water-related issue, too much or too less. And right now, in our situation, it's probably too less. So I would go in and water. Hostas are typically shade plants, although they will tolerate sun, but the sun has adverse effects on it without killing it outright. Adverse effects meaning wilting, some sun bleaching, and things like that.
All right. And what about cutting the flowers off? Is that a good idea? Or?
Well, that's a variable thing. Some people like those flowers because they're quite attractive and they're fragrant. But personally, I choose to cut them off because they flower irregularly. And they, to me, they're many of them aren't that showy.
All right. We are going to take a short break. I'm talking with Linda Nave, Extension Program Specialist in the Extension Value Added Agriculture Program at Iowa State University, and DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh. You can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh. Linda Nave is also here, ISU Extension Program Specialist, and they are here to answer your questions about plants and trees. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Lori's on the line from somewhere in southeast Iowa. Hi, Lori.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I have a question about a particular bug that I found in my high tunnel. I'm an organic farmer, and I have a very small, probably less than half an inch long bug that looks like a walking stick, but it has wings and it flies. But I usually find them in pairs attached at the back of their abdomen, and I can't seem to find a picture of it anywhere. Wondering if you might know what that is.
I have a question. Are the wings very lacy and large compared to the size of the insect?
Yes, they are, Linda.
Are they very bright green kind of colored?
No. No, they are completely brown, and I would say the wings are they're very light brown colored, and they don't look like a lace wing. They're thinner than a green lace wing leaf.
Okay.
Almost like a wing on a mosquito, but their bodies look like walking sticks.
Do they have a very, when you have to look at them closely, but do they have a very skinny waist? If you were to have a waist?
It may be
a wasp. Wasps are known, one of the characteristics of a wasp is that they have a very skinny waist. And that's the best way I can describe it. I'm sure the entomologists have a more technical term for it. And it may be a wasp, and it may be a beneficial wasp. Which one, I don't know. The best way, I guess, is to send it in and have it identified. Just if you could put it in some kind of a protective container and send it in, that would be the best thing. But my guess, I would search, if you're going to be doing a search, it would be search for wasps.
Okay, I'll try that. Do I have time for a second question?
Quickly.
Okay, grasshoppers. I'm having some real defoliation issues on horseradish, beans, even potatoes. Any organic methods for controlling grasshoppers?
Oh, that's a tricky one. It's mostly get rid of the environment that's conducive to their habitat. In other words, all tall grassy areas you have around the farm, around the area, keep things down, keep the weeds down. That's a cultural method in which you can control the grasshoppers. And it's not real. I mean, it'll help a lot, but it's not going to really control the large populations. It's the weather that we're experiencing right now is bringing them out, too.
All right. Well, good luck. And let's go next to Wyatt on the phone in Lytton. Hi, Wyatt.
Hi. How are we doing, guys?
Good. What's your question?
Well, I'm going to school down in Iowa City. I used to live on a farm in rural west central Iowa. And just noticed my father's tree lines is really dying. I mean, it's full of pines. I don't know the variety. But it's not really my question why they're dying. I guess my question is I eventually want to move on that farm and live there. I wonder what a good hardy tree line would be. And if you guys have any suggestions, and we're thinking maybe buckeye trees, but I don't know. I'm open for anything, for any of your guys' knowledge. So I'll take my answer off the line.
All right. Well, you want to stay? You want him to stick
around?
I want
to ask a quick question. Okay. So you said this is going to be out in west central Iowa is where this windbreak will be?
Yes, sir.
What's another town close to there?
It's between Sac City and Rockwell City on Old Highway 20.
Gotcha. Well, the first thing you need to do, Wyatt, is to really look at the soil conditions. And so work with your local NRCS, find out what the soil types are there, and then really try to find species that are going to be adaptive to those soil conditions. Because if it's sandy versus clay, that's going to have a big impact on and what you can plant. The other thing is what I would look for is trying to plant maybe a couple rows of different species. Try to really mix it up. That way, if you have any disease or insect problems. But this is really the million-dollar question because we don't have a lot of species out there. We can just say this is a great species. We have so many different issues with different things. There is no just one tree that, hey, this is the tree to plant. But when I'm looking at evergreens, I think of species like eastern red cedar, Norway spruce, white pine. There's a few others, but that depends on soil types. And then if I'm looking at shrubs, there's a number of different shrubs I could use too. But the thing I wouldn't do is I would stay away from species like blue spruce. We're starting to see problems with arborvitae. Arborvitae was one that I loved. If you didn't have deer, arborvitae was a pretty good one, but we're starting to see some issues with that too. So if you had three rows, you might plant two rows of evergreens depending on what the soil conditions. You can also contact your district forester in your county. If you go to iowadnr.gov, they can help you look at your soils and really plan ahead and say, okay, these are our soils. These are the species that will be adaptive, and then start planting from there. And that'll be the best way to try to reduce potential problems. But diversity, if you can mix different species in, say, 2 to 3 rows, that's going to be the way to really have something long-term. Because if you have a problem with pine, usually it's not going to be a problem on spruce and vice versa or cedar. So the more you can mix it up. But that soil is the ultimate thing that decides what's going to grow there.
All right, yeah, we do have records of slightly acidic. I think it's 6.9. 6.9. But, I very much appreciate your guys' insight, and have a lovely day.
All right, Wyatt, thanks a lot for your call, and you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Let's go to Marianne next in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Marianne. Marianne, are you there? All right. Well, I guess we won't go to Marianne next in Cedar Rapids. Let's do an email question here. This is about peony plants. My peony plants are covered with white mold. Is this dangerous, and what should be done about it?
It's probably a fungal organism that's on it right now, particularly if it's in a very in a location where it's susceptible to that. Is it dangerous? It'll probably the foliage may die back a little prematurely. We see a number of situations with diseases on peonies, leaf spots and that sort of thing. And it doesn't totally affect the plant. The plant will eventually die back, and you can even cut it back if it looks unsightly, and it'll survive just fine.
All right. Let's try Marianne again. Hi, Marianne.
Hi.
Hi there. What's your question?
My question is about tomato plants. I'm kind of a novice tomato grower, and I have two plants that are about 5 feet high, beautiful green. I have, you know, yellow flowers, but I have very few tomatoes budding. And I'm wondering if I'm doing something wrong.
Are they growing in full sun?
They have full sun about, I don't know, 5 hours a day.
That's a borderline amount for tomatoes. Typically, we want 6 to 8 hours. Full sun all day is best. And that lack of fruit set is a symptom of maybe not full sun conditions. Or is it shaded by trees, shaded by each other?
I guess it's shaded by the house next door.
Okay.
We have a lot of trees in our yard, and so this was the sunniest spot against the west-facing wall of the house. So it gets that 3 to 6, 7, 8 p.m. sun.
Sure. And when they started blooming, sometimes if it's really hot during the day and in the evening, the flowers don't set fruit. So it could be a combination between the shade and the heat. Maybe give it a little time when it cools off now and see where it goes from here.
All right, Marianne, thanks a lot for your call. And next up, let's go to Leanne in Johnston. Hi, Leanne.
Hi, guys.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, my backyard neighbor and I both have several maple trees planted across our backyards. One of his maple trees is in trouble. It has maybe half the leaves, and then half of the tree is red already.
Okay.
And this is the second year that it's done this. The rest of the leaves that are green are not a really dark green like all the other trees around it. They're a lighter green, and then half the tree is red like it thinks it's fall.
Okay, so here's the deal. This plant is under stress.
Right.
I don't know what caused it. It could be drought-related. How old are these trees, Leanne?
They're probably 45-foot tall trees.
Okay. Well, a couple things I would look at. The first thing I would look at on this particular tree is I would look to see if it has what we call a root flare. And basically at the base of the ground, you should see the trunk, and then the roots usually are just at the surface on a normal growing tree, and they should flare out. If it looks more like a telephone pole, that tree may be too deep in the ground, and that can cause some problems, and trees can actually start to slowly decline. And usually what happens on these trees is they'll start turning fall color early. In some years, they'll leaf out later than normal. Because of the depth of the tree, it actually can actually cause decline. Or sometimes the other thing to look for is what they call girdling roots, stem girdling roots, SGR. This has been researched a lot up in Minnesota at the University of Minnesota. But to look at that base, and sometimes you actually have individual roots growing along the trunk or at the base of the trunk, they're actually cutting into the tree. Mm-hmm. And so those may actually be disrupting the movement of water. So look for those things on that tree. A lot of times if that's what it is, there's not much you can do, especially if it's at a later stage. If the roots are smaller, sometimes you can do some root pruning to try to remove those stem girdling roots. But it could be the depth of the tree or some stem girdling roots or something like that. Or, depending on the location in the soil around that particular tree, even though we had a lot of moisture this spring, you could be looking at some drought stress on that tree. So
okay.
Usually when they're... You'll see this a lot if you look at a lot of the parking lots and businesses. We saw it last year. I'm even seeing a little bit this year. Anytime a tree's stressed, it's going to try to shut down. So usually it's not a disease or an insect. It's usually the environment or the condition of that tree that's causing some stress to that tree.
Okay, so you think that probably my maples are not in danger. It's just this one maple is having problems because of something particular to itself.
I hope. Usually
okay.
That's...
Me too.
A lot of times that's the situation is, again, if there's not a lot of diseases or insects that cause early fall color. Now, with that said, that doesn't mean that your trees aren't in the same environment and maybe they're a little better off right now, but if we get dry again or something, they could still have problems. Or if it's a depth issue or girdling roots, they may not be at the same level yet, and eventually they could have the same problem. That's why I would kind of probe and look at this tree to see if there's anything out of the ordinary, and then also look at your trees. Again, when you look at that tree in the landscape, it should have a nice flare at the base where the roots kind of flare out, and they're kind of right at the surface. If you don't see that, if it looks more like a telephone pole, then I start getting concerned long-term that that tree may have some decline issues or some problems. But if you see that nice flare on your trees and on their trunk structure, that's a good sign for at least the future. But that doesn't mean that there's not something about the soil conditions, if we get the right weather, that it they could still have problems.
All right, Leanne, hopefully it's just an isolated incident. Let's go next to Steve on the line in Redfield. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I have three different types of Italian roasters, pepper plants from three different vendors, and then I have some bell peppers. And what I'm seeing a lot of them is the very tip of the pepper will get a brown spotch on it.
Mm-hmm. What that sounds like is blossom end rot, and we see this quite a bit in tomatoes. We'll see it in zucchini, and we'll see it on tomatoes, and it's caused by inconsistent watering, some heavy watering versus some lighter watering, or drought stress, a combination of that rather than a very consistent water supply. The best thing to do is just keep that plant well watered consistently, and usually we see it on the early set fruits of tomatoes, peppers, and zucchini. As the plant's roots get further into the soil, find new water sources or whatever, we don't see it quite as prevalent, but the best thing to do is just keep plenty of water and a good mulch layer on your plants.
All right, Steve, thanks a lot for your call, and let's go to Ken in Des Moines. Hi, Ken.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What's your question?
I have some roses I've had for 3 years, buck roses, and they've been doing great. And then now all of a sudden this year, there's no new growth on the bottom. They're kind of light on the leaves. They had the brown spots on them. I thought it was a fungus. They're in rocks, so I moved the rocks away because I thought it was too much moisture earlier was causing it. Doesn't seem to be coming out of it. And I didn't know what to do because I don't like to lose them, but.
It sounds like they are under stress, and what's causing that, I'm not sure. It could be too much moisture, then too dry. It could be heat stress. Could be a number of things playing a factor there. As far as the leaf spots, I wouldn't be too concerned about that. I would maybe prune the plant back a little bit right now so that maybe you get a new flush of growth on top, see how that works, and go from there. I wouldn't be spraying anything. I wouldn't be fertilizing unless you're putting water on it right now. Typically, the middle of July is when we stop fertilizing some of our perennial plants.
All right, Ken, and let's squeeze in one more email question. This is from Brian in Cedar Rapids. I planted some Korean lilac suckers, and they were doing quite well until the bunnies started devouring them. Without leaves, do you think they'll come back? I truly believe they rooted well before the onslaught.
Protect them so they don't get hit again and see what happens.
All right. So there's hope.
Wait and see. Yeah, there's always hope, but if the twigs are still green, there is some hope, but you know, it just depends. But I would protect them so they don't get hit anymore and then see what happens.
Charity, I have a quick comment here.
Sure.
The Plant Insect and Disease Clinic, you can email pictures if you take images of insects or problems on your plants to pidc@iastate.edu.
All right.
Or you can call 515-294-0581.
Okay, Linda, thank you so much. Linda Nave, Extension Program Specialist in the Extension Value Added Agriculture Program at Iowa State University. And Mark Vitosh, thank you.
Thank you.
DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh will be back with Horticulture Day next Friday. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Technical support today from Jason Burns. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.